This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. You're familiar with the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. We bring you the conversations on Tuesdays here on Lakeshore Public Radio, not only on Morning Edition and All Things Considered in the mornings and afternoons, but during Regionally Speaking. And we have one of the co-directors with us in the studio to talk about the project, how it's doing going into 2019, and some very exciting news, some big support from a federally supported organization that will help make the Welcome Project grow and go into the next initiative. And we have with us Allison Schutte in the studio. Allison, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, let's get an update here on how the Welcome Project is doing. For folks, you hear the conversations, how did the Welcome Project get started at Valparaiso University and expand to where we are today going into 2019?
We began as a campus project, a story collection project on Valparaiso University's campus in 2009-2010. Liz Werfel, who is Associate Professor of Art and my co-director, she was really interested in starting to capture stories from students that she had worked with in China that were now matriculated over here to take classes, and noticing that they're were moments when they felt included and moments when they felt excluded. And generally, the demographics of our student body was changing at the time. And as we began to think about what it would mean to collect stories, we realized that if it was an audio and video collection documenting a range of student experience, a range of faculty and staff experience about these times when they felt like they belonged or these times they felt like they didn't belong, we could actually use those edited stories to help facilitate conversation about how do we live well together, especially amid increasing diversity. So that's how the project started. And I think it was by 2012 that we had our website up, which is just welcomeproject.valpo.edu. And we post regularly the stories that we edit there. Our practice is to do interviews that are about an hour and a half long, and then edit these 3 to 5 minute stories from them. And we quickly realized that student faculty staff experience was not limited to the boundaries of our campus. And we began to interview residents and think about ourselves as a larger regional collection. I would say that the Flight Paths Initiative, which we see as officially beginning in 2015, mm-hmm. so we're into our third, fourth year now, we were hearing from students that had grown up in Gary about reactions they were receiving from either students or town folk about when people found out they were from Gary, what the different reactions they were getting. At the same time as we started interviewing residents, we were starting to hear about people whose families had grown up in Gary but had left Gary. And we started to hear this larger story that was undergirding both of these experiences. And so when we started poking around, we realized there's a really rich history in the region that we could help document with oral history. So we began to think about what would it mean to interview residents of Northwest Indiana about growing up in Gary and their neighborhood life. If their families stayed, why did they stay? If they left, why did they leave? And that larger picture, we realized we wanted to support in more than just an oral history way. So we began to work with our colleague in history, Heath Carter, who has done civil rights in Northwest Indiana, and really think about what is the larger historical story of Gary and Northwest Indiana that these oral histories point to. That includes the civil rights movement, it includes white flight, it includes businesses moving to the suburbs, it includes the automation of the steel mills, and that impact of disinvestment on Gary. And then for us, we're particularly interested in the region and like how is this still impacting us today and what kinds of conversations might we have as we revisit our past.
Well, you mentioned it here about the expansion just strictly from people who have lived and grown up in Gary into the areas. Now it's gone now into the, as you mentioned, the white flight issue. So you have residents who have basically moved out of Gary into communities like Merrillville and Highland and Griffith and Hammond, and even people who have maybe have grown up in Hammond. They have some great stories to tell, too, and the impact that all of the changes that have happened in Northwest Indiana have made on them as well. It's probably great conversations you picked up as well over the years, and this project in particular, the flight paths is going to bring up, I would imagine.
Yeah, and we have been encouraged to go west and make sure we collect stories in East Chicago and Hammond,
right,
which we have felt limited by our few persons that we are, two co-directors, numerous students, and most of our stories have reflected more on the Porter County side or like Gary Merrillville area. So we have some work to do expanding to the west still for sure. And another gap that we have in the project is right now Flight Paths has been a black, white, and white ethnic story. But we're very aware that there's a Hispanic, Latinx history of the region too. And so one of the holes that we know we need to fill is to start collecting those stories as well. And I'm sure going into other cities west of Gary will also help with that.
And I imagine that this next phase, taking advantage of the project that you've applied for, maybe we should explain first, what does NEH stand for, and how did you all learn about the digital project that NEH has, and the opportunity to apply for a grant that will in turn help you expand the Welcome Project?
So the National Endowment for the Humanities is a federal organization that looks to fund ways that the public can really engage with the humanities in a way that matters to their everyday lives. So we were encouraged to apply for NEH funding by our administrators when we asked them if we could get course release from teaching in order to help spend time on the Welcome Project. And the grants are one way that we can get some funding to buy some course release time. The digital projects for the public was actually a very generative grant. Like, we hadn't necessarily thought about Flight Paths as its own website, but the digital projects for the public is really aimed at creating these digital platforms. So what we are hoping we will have one day is an actual interactive documentary website that will center on a map of Gary and its neighborhoods, as well as the surrounding cities, and that will allow people to encounter the stories from our resident storytellers within historical information about important institutions like St. John's Lutheran Church or their school that they attended or their favorite ice cream shop.
Right.
And also to have a sense of how those individual experiences fit within the larger historical story. Things, practices and policies that were in place, federal policies oftentimes that, for example, subsidized the growth of the suburbs and really impacted cities like Gary. So we want these individual personal stories to be encountered in the larger region story. And we're really grateful for the National Endowments for the Humanities recognizing that Gary's story is actually a national story as well. So it'll be more for, it won't be only for regional residents. It will actually be for Americans generally who are interested in stories of deindustrialization.
That's interesting. When you found out through the NEH that the funds were available and you decided to put the application in to seek a grant, what was the process like? And probably the waiting period was excruciating. Knowing, as we mentioned, that there are a number of there are dozens and dozens, literally dozens of applications that are put in every year to be able to apply for the grant, and they only come down to, what, seven that they choose each year.
Yeah, I think that number changes each year. So yeah. I think this year they might have given money out to more than just seven. But the acceptance rate is pretty low. So the first grant we applied for was actually for the design document, and we didn't get it the first time.
Yeah. Well, I guess you apply and you put in there hoping that you'll get something, and you come up short, but they just keep applying.
Get really good feedback, actually. So once we got the feedback from some of the gaps that we had missed, we went about filling those in, and when we applied again, then we got it on the second round. So the design document was actually the first NEH grant we got for $30,000, and we weren't sure we would get the production grant, which is the one we just got for $100,000. But we're really excited about that. Sorry, it's the prototyping grant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So now we can move from the sketch board or mood board we created for what we hope the website looks like to actually creating substantial parts of it so we can give a proof of concept back to the National Endowment for the Humanities.
What kind of help did the folks from NEH give you as you were going through the process? And you got a nice letter back when you found out about winning the $100,000 award that many people applied, but very few people had gotten chosen. And they particularly apparently liked what the Welcome Project was offering up this time.
Yeah, so I think in terms of support along the way, there's a program director for every grant. And so that's a person that you can call and talk to. You can send drafts of your application to so you can get some feedback before the actual deadline. So there is that one-on-one help that they give. And they have a sense of the process of what happens on the other end. There's a group of reviewers who are comparing these grants as they come in. For the design document, it was a lot of the historians and the humanities scholars. For the prototyping grant, it's the digital media team as well. So
right.
Now you have to have like a really sharp, keen awareness of who's going to build this for you, and not just the people who have the knowledge of the history.
Now that we get into 2019, you have the grant in hand, and you're able to move now into the, as you say, into the next phase, which is the work that's going to be happening on the prototype of the interactive website and the project itself. What's going to happen? What will folks see on welcomeproject.valpo.edu in the weeks and months ahead now?
Well, on the regular website, it will continue to be just the flight paths stories as they're edited.
Mm-hmm.
We will not have something for the public right away. I mean, the prototype, we're actually convening some focus groups, and the first focus group will happen this spring. And we are definitely interested in residents of Northwest Indiana, also professors, instructors at the schools, and some students to help us initially think about what draws people to these kinds of websites. So as we're creating the prototype over the summer, we'll have a sense of what our audience is drawn to, attracted to, looking for. And then by spring of 2020, we'll have some more focus groups that get some exposure to the actual prototype. But none of that will be public yet as we're working out the kinks and the bugs and things like that.
You'll have more people involved. And here again with the focus groups, you'll have a chance to find out more stories that you can get involved in, that in turn will lead to more conversations that you and the students that help out on the project will get to record, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, we're always open for more people to interview. So if anybody's listening today that wants to share their family story or their story about growing up in the region, we're definitely interested in that. We also often will facilitate community conversations around the stories we've created. So Liz Werfel got an Indiana Arts Commission grant about 2 years ago, and we created a 26-minute audio documentary from our resident storytellers that gives a really quick encapsulated history of the region. And we've used that chorus of voices, which you can actually also find on our regular website, to have cross-county conversations about what happens when we hear and revisit the past and the stories of our families. How is that helping us think about where we're at today and who we'd like to be as neighbors today? So sometimes people encounter the stories not just through the website, but through these community conversations as well.
Well, it sounds like 2019 is going to be a very exciting year for the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University, not only with the website itself, but also with all the projects that are going to be going on here as you continue on to this path that you've literally created, the flight paths, to be mm-hmm. sure, as it's called, but certainly the overall path for the Welcome Project to add more conversations in, and in turn we'll be able to present here on Lakeshore Public Radio in the weeks and months ahead.
Yeah, we have a great partnership with Lakeshore Public Media, and we're really grateful for that. We've also really benefited from StoryCorps. They've been helpful on three occasions with helping us collect interviews in the region. So we're really grateful for our partners. And Liz and I certainly could not be doing this on our own. We have colleagues at Valparaiso University. We have colleagues at IUN. We have colleagues at IUPUI. We even have a graphic designer from Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington on our team.
Wow.
So it's a really cooperative, collaborative endeavor. It wouldn't be possible without all of the students that have helped as well.
Well, it's a wonderful thing called the internet that is able to make the connections possible here. It's not only to be able to connect here in Northwest Indiana, but be able to reach out across the country. It sounds like to find the people out there that want to help out, make this project work even more. Well, we've been talking with Allison Schutte. She's an associate professor of English. She, along with Liz Werfel, are the co-directors for the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project has been able to take advantage of funds that in turn have led and the efforts to be able to help fund the project to go into the next phases, and the latest of which is the National Endowment for the Humanities and the $100,000 grant that you've received for the digital project that you're now in right now. Allison, thank you for spending time with us explaining how the Welcome Project works, all of the work that's behind the scenes that is going to make the Welcome Project website even bigger and more expansive, and all the great conversations that you're trying to not only put out there on the website now, but you're trying to gather together to have more people involved and talk about how the great history of Northwest India has grown and it's how it's expanded into what we're going to get to see and hear online. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. We're revisiting conversations from the past year for Greenfleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick, with a conversation from June 13th, 2018.
Well, thank you for that introduction. Today, our guest is Mr. Johnny Van Fleet. He's the head mechanic for the City of Hobart's Public Works Department. Johnny, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, you know, Johnny, we've worked with you for probably 6 or 7 years now, and, you know, we just really use you as the alternative fuel experts, and so we're just so proud of all the things that you've worked with to make Hobart really the green city.
And thank you.
So, you know, Hobart has embraced alternative fuels for years, so what sparked that interest?
Well, Lake County being part of, Hobart being a part of Lake County, is a non-attachment area for air quality, and Hobart has wanted to improve air quality what we can, where we can. So we explored alternative fuels, and that seemed to be one of the biggest creators of cleaner air.
Sure. You know, Johnny, as a head mechanic, you're more than a head mechanic. I mean, your title says it, but you're involved with so many things on making things operate and things fix. And I know a lot of times what happens is, you know, when we work with, folks that they're, you know, you've always embraced alternative fuels just because it was changed. It helped with air quality. But, what would you say to another fleet that potentially is engaging at looking at alternative fuels? Why did you embrace this so much?
Well, one, we're not afraid of change.
That's true.
You know, we'll try anything once. And as far as going with the alternative fuels, it just seemed the right direction, doing our part.
Absolutely. You know, working with the mayor, working from top to bottom, it's wonderful that you've not only embraced compressed natural gas, you've embraced electric, you're looking at other alternative fuels, you're looking at solar, you're looking at different things. And it's just so, enlightening to us to get to work with all the folks of Hobart, just because it's just fun, and it's you're like sponges, you're wanting to learn.
Yes.
And it's just been a great experience. So, you know, to all the listeners out there, if you want to learn and hear about some of the great things that Hobart's done, please get in touch with Johnny and the rest of the crew at the City of Hobart.
Absolutely, anytime.
So how many CNG vehicles or compressed natural gas vehicles do you have now, and how are they being used?
Right now we have 5 that are on the road that are being used. One is a sewer cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is a multitasking truck.
Sure.
It has a grapple claw that goes out and cleans up brush and whatnots, and it changes to a salt spreader, and then it could also haul dumpsters.
Mm-hmm.
We have a garbage truck that runs 5 days a week, picks up trash. We have 2 pickup trucks that the foremans drive.
Mm-hmm.
And we have 2 in the works to be retrofitted from diesel to natural gas. So, and then we plan to add 2 to 3 per year from now on.
Wonderful.
To expand the fleet. And we also have an electric vehicle that our event coordinator uses daily for her errands and stuff like that. So,
So I know the public works staff and the people driving the compressed natural gas vehicles say they prefer them to diesel. So what are you hearing from the staff about these vehicles?
The staff likes it because, one, the engine noise is hardly anything, mm-hmm. and there's no smell.
Sure.
No smell, no black smoke, you know. Even like the kids at the bus stops, when they see the garbage truck go by, there's no poof of black smoke. Sure. It's cleaner air for everybody. And myself being a mechanic, maintenance intervals are longer, mm-hmm. which is less tax dollars, and
everybody wins.
Easier to work mm-hmm. on.
Yes. So we're talking to Mr. Johnny Van Fleet. He's the head mechanic for the City of Hobart's Public Works Department. And so, Johnny, we were with you in January when you did the ribbon cutting for your new compressed natural gas station and public works garage. Mm-hmm. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about those two projects?
Well, the CNG station was needed by far. We got into this without the fuel station and had the trucks. Our trucks were traveling 30 miles round trip just mm-hmm. to fuel. Mm-hmm. It was taking like an hour out of their day just to go fuel up at the end of the day and sure. come back. Now that we have the fuel station on site, one, we're saving an hour of man time. Mm-hmm. Two, the trucks actually fuel up overnight while nobody's there. So mm-hmm. you're even saving time and money there. As far as the new garage, state of the art. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's beautiful. It's CNG compliant. Mm-hmm. We can work on the trucks inside. It's larger, so we can more steadily maintain our fleet.
No, and again, I think as you say, is that there's definitely opportunities for growth within the compressed natural gas market, and you know we look forward to working with on some upcoming opportunities. So, how does the use of the CNG vehicles and fuel help the residents of Hobart?
Well, the use of CNG vehicles helps the residents of Hobart because, one, the CNG emissions are close to none. Mm-hmm. Quiet running. They don't have to hear the loud diesels going down the roads in the morning, you know, first sure. thing. And overall, just the cost.
Sure. And tell our listeners a little bit about that.
The cost, well, like right now, diesel's going for $2.75, $2.85 mm-hmm. a gallon. Last week we computed it. I think we're paying 90 cents a gallon for CNG.
Sure. Without any incentives.
Without any mm-hmm. incentives.
Correct.
You know, and our garbage trucks have – the CNG garbage truck has double the fuel mileage as a diesel.
Now, all exciting stuff. So how can people learn more about the Hobart's alternative fuel vehicles and some of your green programs?
Well, at any time they can contact me, mm-hmm. John Dubach, talk to any city employee. They'll touch on it. And South Shore Clean Cities has helped us produce a video that shows our part – in clean air and mm-hmm. clean water. And
well, Johnny, you know, in regards to your efforts, you know, we thank you for being that sponge, you know, being great to work with. And again, I know that offer is there for any community, any organization that potentially is looking
Absolutely.
At moving towards alternative
Absolutely.
fuels. And you know, we're just proud to say that we've partnered with you on this, and we're just excited about the future for not only for the city of Hobart but for the residents of Hobart and Lake County. So
it's been fun.
That will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thanks again to Johnny Van Fleet, head mechanic for the City of Hobart's Public Works Department. And I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks again for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Once again, reminder that the prices that you heard Johnny talk about were from June 13th of 2018. Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. You can hear Green Fleet Radio right here on Regionally Speaking on Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are also on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. Well, where really are the best places to live in the state of Indiana, or for that matter, here in Northwest Indiana? Well, let's find out with the help of homesnacks.net. They have put out on their website the latest list in 2019 for the best communities to live in. And we have with us Nick Johnson, who is with homesnacks.net, to talk about it. Nick, thanks for joining us on the program today.
No problem, Chris. Hope you're having a good day.
Yeah, I am. We're trying to, and we hope that we will. And certainly, if we live in one of the communities that's on the list here, a lot of people there certainly will be happy to know that, too. Please explain for us, first off, what homesnacks.net is and how you folks there at the website help put together the list of the best places to live in Indiana.
Homesnacks is what we call regional infotainment. So we like to do different rankings on what it's like to live in different places. We do everything from the best and worst places to the drunkest and best places to retire. So anything that you could possibly measure, we try to make an educated, scientific-based guess on how a state would rank in different categories.
Now, how did you folks come up with the rankings for this year's list?
Traditionally, when you decide if a place is going to be good or not, I mean, you're going to look at quality of life factors such as, you know, home prices and jobs and crime and the quality of the schools and even the weather when you're going to decide if a place is great or not. So believe it or not, even within a state level, you're going to have different weather patterns. So we throw all of the different data into an algorithm, and we have an unbiased look at statistically where the best and worst places should be in a state based on data.
Now, of course, the best places to live, I know, is a much, much, much bigger list in Indiana than the worst places list. But unfortunately, the two worst places happen to be in Northwest Indiana, too. We'll get to those before we finish up today. But let's go down the list here and take a look at these places. And there are quite a few, surprisingly, here in Northwest Indiana that are at the list here. And near the top, if almost at the top, number three is the community of St. John. Number four in the list is the community of Dyer. If we go through all the data that you say that you go through there at homesnacks.net to come up with these, what are the things that seem to stand out the most, first off here, about St. John and about Dyer?
I'm looking at the data right now when we're talking. I mean, if you're going to look at places up there in the Northwest area, a lot of people in England don't realize that, you know, that part of the state actually has a good quality of life. When you're looking at, you know, crime levels, they're going to be lower than they are in other parts of northern Indiana, like Elkhart and even South Bend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's decent family life up there, you know, decent jobs, and the home prices are relatively affordable for the quality of life that you have. So if you were to measure jobs versus quality of life versus home prices versus crime, you're going to see that part of the state actually stands out really well.
Mm-hmm. I noticed, too, that besides St. John and Dyer being at in the top 10 of the list here, the community of Munster is number 7. And we'll take a moment here. Let's go down the rest of the list here. We take a look here at past the top 10. Chesterton's number 14. Valparaiso's number 15. The community of Lowell in Lake County is 22nd. Griffith, also in Lake County, is 25th, and 27th place is Schererville. 28th is Winfield, which is, of course, a growing community here in Lake County. And over in LaPorte County and in Porter County, communities like Portage, as well as Cedar Lake, and in Lake County, and Rensselaer, and Hobart, and Merrillville, and LaPorte are also on the list, too. Crown Point's in there as well, too. Number 11, by the way, can't forget them. They're up there just under the top 10 list here. When you come up with these rankings, I know it's really tough to determine the best for a list. Everybody has an idea of what they consider being the best town best city to live in. How do you break out the list when you want to go down to some of the smallest communities all across the state?
That's interesting because, you know, we get a lot of letters and emails from people that say, you know, I love it where I live, and, you know, I don't want to live in an Indianapolis suburb. I want to live out in the middle of nowhere because mm-hmm. it's peaceful and quiet, and it's actually relatively safe, and, you know, I like open places, and that's fine. I think for the most part, I think we draw the line at a city of 5,000 people or more because you can't really measure crime and cost of living in a town like, you know, just outside of Indianapolis, like Carmel or Zionsville, versus a tiny town like Hillsboro in Fountain County, which has 200 people. So you have to be able to statistically measure using, you know, commonalities like population. But we do have a list where we do have the top and bottom tiny towns in Indiana as well. We tend to keep those in a separate category.
Yeah. Well, tell us about those. When you go down to say under 5,000 population, some people, as we know, just love living in tiny towns like that. Well, how does the list rank for tiny towns here in Indiana? What seem to be the best tiny town, so to speak, according to your latest list from homesnacks.net?
Believe it or not, I don't know if anybody's heard of a place called Battleground.
Oh, yeah. North and east of Lafayette. In fact, they call it Battle Crown because that's where the Battle of Tippecanoe State Memorial is located up there. So, yeah, it's a nice community, a very small community, but a very nice one, I understand.
So I actually spent 5 years in Lafayette, I lived in a small town just on the Illinois border, and then I lived in Lafayette for a number of years. So I'm familiar with both small and medium-sized and large towns in Indiana. Battleground is just a quiet place. It's relatively peaceful. You know, I think you're going to find that in Indiana, you're going to find that all across the state, there's going to be cute little small towns that everybody loves and they think are the best. So there's going to be a lot of similarities between the numbers. What it comes down to is just small statistical differences in home prices and crime. Basically, when you're measuring a place with 3,000 people versus another place with 3,000 people, it's going to be, you know, how many break-ins happened last year.
Well, Nick, now that we've taken a look at the list broken down for the best places to live in Indiana, and they include quite a few here in Northwest Indiana on the list, unfortunately, two of the three places that are considered the worst places to live in Indiana just happen to be in Lake County. Tell us about how it turns out that East Chicago and Gary ended up on the list.
Well, I don't think anybody's going to be surprised, Chris, that East Chicago and Gary are going to be atop any list of the worst places to live. I mean, it's statistically, they are not only the most dangerous places to live in Indiana, but some of the most dangerous places to live in the country. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of opportunity there. Crime is high. Commute times are relatively low. But, you know, if you're going to look at the commute times, you're going to have to also look at who has a job. The unemployment rates are above 10% in those areas as well. So that's always going to be the only part of Indiana, that northern strip from Elkhart, South Bend, over to the Illinois border in East Chicago. That's always going to be the place in Indiana mm-hmm. where you don't want to go if you're looking to raise a family.
Well, I guess there's always room for improvement, and certainly these locations and many of around the state as well, but here, these two in particular in Northwest Indiana are doing their best to kind of go up in the rankings to be sure here. So, well, Nick, thank you very much for spending time giving us the latest list on the best and, in some cases, the worst places to live in Indiana. And we appreciate your help and all the folks at homesnacks.net putting all this data together. Thank you for talking about it today.
Yeah, no problem. And I'd like to add, we do like to rank all kinds of factors on our YouTube page. If you look up Homesnacks on YouTube, what's interesting about Indiana is we do a lot of the same types of rankings, state level for nationwide rankings for videos that we do. And Indiana never really comes up. And what's interesting about that is we tend to talk about the best, the highs and lows, if you will, if we're going to compare states across the country. And Indiana never comes up. They're never the best in anything, and they're never the worst in anything. Indiana is just Indiana.
Good way to put it, I suppose, too. Nick Johnson is with homesnacks.net. The byproducts of a strong economy and low unemployment are forcing Indiana police and fire departments to look harder for qualified applicants. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brock Turner tells us, a bill that lawmakers are considering this General Assembly session could make it easier for departments to find the help that they need.
Jerry Purcell was born and raised in Richmond, Indiana. One day after he graduated from college at Ball State, he submitted his application for the Richmond Fire Department. He faced stiff competition, and it took him years to finally be hired. He's now the chief.
I started in the fire service 35 years ago. You had to live in the city of Richmond to even apply for our department. And I wasn't happy when that expanded out to contiguous county, to be quite honest with you.
Fast forward 35 years, and the situation is vastly different.
We used to get 260 applicants every other year for this job. I now have a continuous open hiring process and have 8 vacancies.
Purcell says that's costing taxpayers $250,000 in overtime.
That is a burden on the taxpayers. It's a burden on my members who have to work and be ordered in to work the ambulances shift after shift after shift. So for those reasons, I need to get hired up.
Purcell says he has to order firefighters in to provide essential emergency services. Unlike some businesses, he doesn't have the luxury of serving fewer people or cutting the number of services he provides. When labor is tight, he's expected to do more with less.
No one wants to take the overtime, then we'll order a member in. And that can be someone coming in here working 72 hours, et cetera, straight. And that's not healthy with the run load we currently have. We do just around 11,000 runs a year.
The president of Indiana State Fire Union, Tom Hanafy, says Richmond is not an outlier. Departments across the state are struggling to find quality applicants.
It's getting harder to hire police officers and firefighters across Indiana. The job market's better. That's a good thing. That's a great thing. We all want that. But also getting eligible people to want these jobs when there's so many other options to them, it makes it a little more difficult.
State Senator Mark Messmer is sponsoring a bill that would loosen the residency requirements police and firefighters currently face. State law requires public safety workers to live no further than a contiguous county away from the department they're serving in. While simple, that creates some unusual circumstances.
I had a constituent in southern Spencer County that lived about 15 miles from Evansville, but was in a non-contiguous county.
Messmer is hopeful the bill will help individuals and departments. In past sessions, however, language that would allow out-of-state residents to work for departments in Indiana has derailed the bill.
If they try to throw it in, it'll probably be the demise of the bill, so I would object to adding the out-of-state language to it.
Even though Purcell hopes he can eventually cross state lines, he's willing to accept anything that might help. He and Hanafy agree that the bill won't solve all of their staffing struggles. They say having a common statewide standard is important and hope this bill will begin to move the needle. Carefully screening the applicants they do receive remains critically important. Hanafy says departments need the best people.
We have to make it a little more flexible for local governments to hire the best people. And don't forget, we want the best people. When I go in to that incident, that burning building, that catastrophe, I want the person that's walking in there with me to be competent. I don't want to lower our standards. We want competent, good, quality people.
Purcell agrees and is doing everything in his power to keep his department fully staffed. Both say serving citizens is their only goal.
These are people with servants' hearts that want to help people. And people say that firefighters want to help people. No, they have to help people. That's the way they're wired. And so, no, our people are going to do a tremendous job helping people, but we're going to burn them out.
And that's the story he hopes to share with legislators when he testifies in favor of the bill. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brock Turner.
A Hobart High School graduate has come back to Northwest Indiana to create a business which in turn is helping folks that have special needs to be able to enjoy life, in particular by taking cruises. We have with us to talk about it Kathy Schoaf. Thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I am happy to join you. I am actually on the Holland America MS Oosterdam in the middle of the Eastern Caribbean.
Oh, my.
On a group cruise with a group of dementia-friendly clients and their caregivers. Mm-hmm. And we are having an amazing time. So I'm excited to talk to you. The view outside of my window right now does not include snow.
Well, unfortunately, my view does, you know, at least not from the studio, but certainly outside the building.
I was hearing that.
Yes, that's the case here. Well, tell us a little bit, Kathy, tell us a little bit about growing up in Hobart, going to high school in Hobart, and eventually, too, ending up going to Ball State University to get your nursing degree. What was the experience like going from Northwest Indiana all the way over to Eastern Indiana to Muncie to get your degree and then coming back to Northwest Indiana and eventually to create Elite Cruises and Vacations?
Well, my life in Northwest Indiana was amazing. I had a wonderful high school experience consisting of biology and lots of music hours. I also have worked many hours with music performance, which is probably what actually led me to Ball State. I performed aggressively and studied music at both Valparaiso and Ball State and then ended up a BSN in nursing. Mm-hmm. And so my career has taken me all over the country. I have lived in Texas and Illinois and Pennsylvania and New York, California. And I come back to Northwest Indiana excited and happy to base my business there, but I have clients in 39 states and all over Canada.
Now, you take the business Elite Cruises and Vacations, and you've turned it into a very specialized travel agency. What was it your nursing experience that got you in that direction?
Absolutely. I was the director of nursing and regional director for senior living options, for home health agencies, for hospice communities. And I just wanted somehow to create a way that everyone could still enjoy their life. I wanted to give families, loved ones, caregivers the opportunity to still enjoy their loved ones' experiences with their loved ones, with their families, without any barriers. So we create travel options for clients with cognitive impairment, dementia, COPD, heart issues, cancer complications, Alzheimer's disease, weakness, slow walkers, Parkinson's, and any other conceptual medical issue that exists. I travel with a group of professionals, including additional RNs, and we see that everyone has a safe, comfortable, happy experience.
What's it like to be able to set up your business to work with so many professionals as well as members of the family of the people who are really, I'm sure, enjoy the cruises as much, if not more so, than other people do? What's it like to be able to work with all these professionals and, in turn, working with the cruise lines, since you have, in this case, you're working with the Holland American Cruises?
The professionals that I work with are very, very carefully handpicked. We all have a very like-minded attitude to get the job done, because I don't necessarily have the ability to anticipate what complications, challenges might exist, and we have to be prepared to handle all of those challenges and meet the needs of not only our clients but all of their caregivers. Number one priority, keeping everyone safe, and number two, providing an experience which allows them to have lifelong amazing memories. As far as working with the cruise lines, I'm also very careful how I choose those cruise lines. We work with Holland America and Celebrity Cruise Lines because they are anxiously willing to be supportive and communicative about what I need their staff to do in order to make this successful. I have had the privilege to have dinner with the president of Holland America. I meet with the full cruise ship staff, including the captain and his other officers, before we ever sail. Everyone's fully aware of what challenges we are bringing on board his ship. But on the other hand, he has an MD on every single ship, and I do not hesitate to send a client to see a doctor if we have an issue. And I assure him that we will manage, you know, situations and problems as they arise and seek professional assistance as needed.
Mm-hmm. Are you aware, if it just happens to be in this case, what you mentioned with Holland America, that this particular cruise line has thought so well ahead in being able to take advantage of having passengers of this type on board their ships? Maybe some of the other cruise lines, if they haven't already, that they might be following suit, and you'll be having more opportunities out there for more cruises?
At this time, Holland America is excited about the opportunities. Like I said, Celebrity is also. I don't see that kind of conversation coming from any other lines right now.
Uh-huh.
But Holland America, and between Holland America and Celebrity, I can honestly travel with clients any place in the world, literally on all seven continents, any place in the world that anyone would wish to go. There's no exclusions. We are willing to take a group to take to whichever parts of the world they are interested in going. And we have 9 cruises scheduled for 2019 right now, which will be created in groups. And we're more than happy to add to that list with someone showing interest.
Well, it sounds like this is a great opportunity for people who maybe would never, ever have a chance to be on a cruise ship anytime during their life and during the time that maybe that they might need some help, and certainly an opportunity to enjoy themselves the most. It sounds like the Kathy, you and others that you work with Elite Cruises and Vacations are on the right track, and you've got plenty of things planned. So you're going to keep a lot of people busy on taking advantage of a lot of cruises in the future. And we're glad that you spent some time to talk about this with us today.
Thank you so much. I receive many, many accommodations and wonderful, happy clients that come and return and travel with us repeatedly. You know, we're always seeking to be able to have new first-time clients to our group, but many of our cruisers, travelers come back and travel with us additionally again.
We've been talking with Kathy Schoaf. She is an RN. She's a native of Northwest Indiana, went to Hobart High School, attended Valparaiso University. She's also a Ball State University graduate. That's where she got her nursing degree. And she has created and takes advantage of opportunities to set up cruises with her own company, a specialized travel agency called Elite Cruises and Vacations, where those folks who have special needs in particular can enjoy the time being on the cruise ship like anybody else can. 2 weeks of bad weather in Indiana has resulted in critically low levels of blood supply. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on the shortage and a call for donations.
Bad weather has impacted both on-site blood donations and mobile drives. The Indiana Blood Center needs more than 550 blood donations a day to have ample stock, and they currently have 1 day's supply less than they need. Dan Waxman, Chief Medical Officer at the Indiana Blood Center, says they provide blood and plasma to hospitals and trauma centers across the state.
And these trauma centers need blood products at the ready to handle the cases. And some of these cases can literally go through several hundred blood products.
Anyone in good health who is 17 or older can donate blood in Indiana. The center says it is especially in need of O negative donations. O negative is universal and is used in the ER when there is no time to determine blood type. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Indiana is the third best state in the country for driving. That's according to a new study out from WalletHub.com. The Hoosier State is only behind Illinois and Oregon, which is the best, according to the study. Gil Gonzalez with Wallet Hub says the company looked at 30 factors. Safety was one of them.
We also looked at costs of ownership and maintenance, everything from gas prices to low auto maintenance costs.
And infrastructure was also examined in putting together the list and Indiana's number three ranking.
We looked at traffic and infrastructure. Days with precipitation, road quality, bridge quality, all of which Indiana ranked pretty well for.
That's Jill Gonzalez, an analyst with WalletHub.com. Lakeshore Public Radio's newest furry friend, Ollie, is with us in the studio now to answer your pet's questions. The questions are voiced by woman-human Victoria Voller, and Ollie's responses are voiced by man-human Tom Maloney. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Dear Ollie, I'm writing you today about sugar. Sugar, a.k.a. Suga, one of your Maltese Shih Tzu mixed dogs that I adopted from the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana many, many years ago. She found her forever home with me. Getting old is not for sissies, even if you're a happy dog. Suga is now almost 14 years old. She loves the world like no one I ever knew. But she is deaf, and at the same time, she has lost most of her vision in her right eye. She did have an ulcer on that eye, which has been healed, but combined with a cataract, that affects her sight. Her temperament has changed, understandably, and she's disoriented at times. But I love her. I want nothing more than to give her a good old age and try to accept my limitations at that. I adore her and won't be surprised if she's still around for quite a while. That's what I hope. I just love that funny, smart, stubborn, beautiful, feisty little girl, and I can see her on the first day that she was adopted. And that is how I shall always remember her. For her short time on this earth, she lit up my life. I'm fortunate to have shared part of my life with this wonderful creature that has such a great capacity for devotion and love. Signed, Sharon Blessam, Pittsboro, North Carolina.
Dear Sharon, anyone who has struggled with the sadness of caring for an aging dog can relate to your sentiments. Aging in a dog is much like aging in a human being. Health issues abound, as they do with older humans. The average lifespan of a dog is about 10 to 12 years, so you've had Suga longer than usual. Our executive director, Frida White, just lost her beloved dog, Bella, and she was 12. Don McAuliffe, one of our corporate supporters, lost his dog, Molly, in the same way she did, suddenly. Molly, too, appeared to be in good health and had just turned 13 years old. Unfortunately, death is an equal opportunity for both people and their pets. I guess I have to weigh in on this since I just celebrated my 13th birthday. I'm not as fast as I used to be, and I stumble when going down the stairs. I remember when my friend Oscar turned 14 and began to go downhill. I challenged him for the position of pack leader and made his life miserable. When Oscar died, I took the opportunity to step in and be the number one dog. I'm now large and in charge of all the other dogs in the residence and, of course, the kitchen. No, getting older is not for sissies, and I'd rather be like Peter Pan and never grow old, but that's not the plan. So I enjoy my dinner, afternoon snacks, my walks in the Gabus Arboretum, rides in the car to get puppy cups from Culver's or whipped cream from Starbucks, and running the show here. I also have an apprentice writer who will take over for me when I'm gone. His name is Freddie, and he has a lot to learn. But he's a quick study, though I won't ever tell him that. He doesn't text, but he can write and will keep things going, so to speak. Good luck to you and Sugar, and appreciate every day you have together. Life is short for us dogs. Signed, your friend in fur, Ollie.
And if you have a question for your friend in fur, Ollie, you can email it to ollie@lakeshorepublicmedia.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Tomorrow is Thursday, means it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. And we will have on, from the Northwest Indiana Gazette blog, Ken Davidson. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson will join us, and we'll also bring back our conversation earlier this week with Ed Feigenbaum from Indiana Gaming Insight Newsletter. Hope you'll join us.